Pete Rose logged more hits in baseball history than anyone else. No one has come close to breaking his record. But he was also at the center of one of the game's biggest scandals, a scandal that changed baseball forever. In the new book, Charlie Hustle, New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien chronicles Pete Rose's spectacular rise and fall. Drawing on firsthand interviews with Rose himself and his associates, this is Pete Rose as we've never seen him before. By Charlie Hustle, available wherever books are sold.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Danny Wallace, and I've been writing about men for years.
I'm Phil Hilton, and I've been working in men's magazines for decades.
And this is Manatomy.
Oh, I'm an alcoholic, mate. I was a complete pisshead. I think I did it to numb out feelings I've had since childhood. And people go, whoa, okay, like that.
I'd use the adrenaline to basically ask almost impossible things of my body, which I wouldn't be able to do now.
But even when I'm at my smallest, like I am right now, which is nice, I'm still the biggest person in the room.
Obviously, the longer they take, the better the job they do. And if you don't look too closely, as the camera flies over your head, it looks like you've got a full head of hair.
Hello and welcome to Manatomy. It's a bit like that Levi's ad from the 80s where the man stood in the laundrette and stripped down to his boxers, except with normal men with normal bodies. We go a little deeper than skin deep today with a brilliant guest, but before we do, Phil, what have you found this time?
Well, there's a fascinating little media explosion about Emmanuel Macron over in France, who has revealed by unbuttoning four buttons on his shirt that he has an unbelievably dense set of chestal hairs going on in there. And this caused a huge debate about was he trying to win the election, which I'm very glad he won, actually, as we record this, with his chest hair, proving his virility, or should he wax it all off? And the internet, as ever, flung itself into a heated debate. I have extensive grey chest hair myself, which I'm not happy with, but I'm more scared of the removal process than I am of living with it. So far, I've been living with it. What's your chest hair scenario?
I suppose I have some. For a while, I had like three, and I quite liked them. And I wanted to sort of, give them a chance. You know, give them a chance to grow. And now I've got more. There's some there. But they're yet to go great. I don't know what to do with them. I don't really understand the etiquette's the wrong word. But you know, I don't know what the look is. Your hair on your chest. Are you annoyed that it's dense, or are you annoyed that it's grey? Would you consider dyeing it, Phil?
Dye your chest hair? I wouldn't, because it'd be appalling vanity. But I hate it both for its density. I mean, you can't see the nipples, really. They're hidden under. It performs like, you know, like a mist has dropped on the hills. It looks like that, because it just sort of covers them, and they're under there somewhere. I hate it because it's a big age tell as well. So you look sort of ancient warrior on his last legs. You know, he's fought off the others. He's the last man standing, and he's covered in grey hair. That's
just
what
a
like.
Lovely little fuzzy ball by the campfire. I think, you know, you could. I mean, the thing is, if you dyed it, the problem is, you know, when you see men who've properly dyed their beards, like your kind of Rylands or your Evgeny Lebedevs, and they are so jet black that it's almost like it's like that. Remember they made that substance that was the blackest of all black, that no light can come back of it. It's a bit like that. And if you had that all over your body, I mean, you'd be able to hide at night pretty well. You could be a naked burglar. No one will be able to see you. It's just the glint of the grey given away by the passing car lights, Phil, that would out you as a burglar. But I think you should embrace your fuzziness. And I'm glad that Macron did as well. I think that's nice. If he'd unbuttoned it and he'd waxed it into like a perfect love heart or maybe a croissant to show his that he also loves his nation as much as the far right claim to, then perhaps that would have been something. But I always thought he'd be quite smooth. It's quite surprising.
I caught mine in a zip the other day. I had one of those zippy tops, and I just caught a bit of chest hair as I was zipping it down. It's a pretty, it's a low moment in any middle-aged man's life. Why was I wearing a zip top anyway? I could ask myself a few searching questions there. And then the pain. And then it was sort of, I was sort of out, and it happened, and I kind of initially pulled the face and wanted to start crying and then repressed the pain to save any further humiliation. Beware, men out there with chest hair. It's dangerous as well as unsightly.
Yeah, these are the things that women just don't appreciate, I think. And, you know, it's a daily danger. What a great guest we have this week on Menatomy. And he's very honest. He's very funny. And he talks a lot about things that we haven't really talked about. And this is someone that you've worked with for years. Our paths have crossed many times over the years, but you really know him. So perhaps you'd like to tell us about him.
Yeah, I've known Sam since the 90s, actually. He's about 10 years, just over 10 years younger than me, and I took him on his work experience when I was editing Men's Health. And he was instantly one of those guys you think, oh my God, he's brilliant. And he's just gone on and on to be to have this amazing career. So he's, as a print journalist, he's been in The Guardian, and he's written three books, and one of them is the brilliantly titled Night of the Living Dad, about being a parent. He's a great radio presenter. Check him out. His work on TalkSport is extraordinary. In the middle of all this, he edited Heat magazine for a few years. He's one of those blokes, when you go out with him and his stories are so funny, you then go back and try and do them for your wife, and you kill them all dead. And that's what makes him this fantastic podcast presenter. So he's got Top Flight Time Machine, which is his big one, ostensibly about football, but just about Sam and his other half, Andy Dawson, being brilliant. He's got one about West Ham, which I don't know about because I don't understand about football, called You Irons. And then there's The Reset, which is mental health without all the bollocks. And boy, does he open up mental health to men in an extraordinary way, dealing with addiction, dealing with self-medication. He's so honest and fantastic about it. He's an inspiring person, which is a really weird thing to say about a mate, but he is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in this episode, he talks about, as you say, addiction and self-doubt. And there's some very funny stories there as well about coming across fellow football fans. So let us explore the body of Sam Delaney.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. We're so pleased you are here. I should say as well that you and Phil have a long and storied history together, right, Phil?
We've known each other for decades, haven't we? You were, in fact, work experience, weren't you? And you were the workie on Men's Health, weren't you, when I was the editor? That's how far back we go.
My first job, my first two or three jobs, taught me everything I know. For anyone who's despised my content over the years and my outlook in the public sphere, and I know there's plenty of you, Phil is effectively to blame.
You're one of those sort of intimidating upcomers who I knew would overtake me and sort of run a massive tank of success over my shabby career. Which
what,
you
so
done.
You thought, get in there, get him. Get him and crush him.
Early. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite. Work on him in a series of different psychological ways to really grind him down over the years. But you rose anyway. The first thing we do on Menatomy is we ask our guest, for anyone who can't see them, is to describe yourself physically in whatever way you like as you sit here today.
I am a 6'2" Caucasian male. I have a bald head, which I disguise like very, really regularly with hats these days, mainly baseball caps. I've got spectacles on. I'm quite gangly, but I'm increasingly hefty, age 47. I've got a bit of a belly. I've got very large, powerful thighs, large feet, and rubbery facial features. Those are probably the key things to mention. Yeah,
where do the large thighs come from? Is this exercise bikes or?
No, they're just sort of naturally like it, to the extent that I almost have to limit the amount of exercise I do with them because they'll get too big. Some people have referred to them as my haunches, and I was really self-conscious about it. I used to do a show on TalkSport with Jason Cundy, and he'd go, "What's going on with your haunches?" And I say, what are you talking about? And he goes, they're weird. You're a freak of nature. He goes, you're slim, because I used to be a lot slimmer. And he went, apart from, he goes, you've got normal head, normal shoulders, normal arms, normal calves, but your haunches are like enormous, like a horse. And I become, he'd go on about my haunches, and like I became really self-conscious about them. And I have been ever since, just from the knee up to the arse. It's just like, they're just, it's huge. And if I do too many like squats or anything like that, it gets out of control. So it's quite difficult, you know, when you're buying trousers. I have to go in and specify to them in the shop, you know, like, I've got a haunches problem. Have you got any for the larger haunched man?
You sound like a fawn.
Yeah, that's how I think of myself. For those.
There's no equivalent of high and mighty, is there, for the large of thigh? No. There should be. It's an idea.
Maybe it's something I should start, yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, just that impression you did there of the footballer Jason Cundy there, and it was like, he was full on sort of... It reminds me that you're the corners of the media that you've always inhabited have always... The laddiness, I mean, that was in the past now. Now you're a grown man. But there was always that element of like, boys, men, lads, and that kind of sort of mickey-taking, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's sort of... I mean, that's kind of how I sort of grew up in an environment that was quite like that, I suppose, and grew up like the youngest of four brothers in a sort of very raucous environment. And I was the youngest by some margin, like by 7 years. There was a 7-year gap. And we grew up in a house in like a single parent family where there was a lot of people around and a lot of boisterousness and noisiness and piss taking. As the youngest, I had to really sharpen up and hone my skills in that sort of field to sort of defend myself, because I'd bear the brunt of it for many years in my childhood until one day I became the best at it and have been wreaking horrible revenge on them ever since. But yeah, so, and but then that, you know, so I suppose that's why, and like, as Phil will testify, you know, I got involved in men's magazines during the sort of Lad Mag era. And I suppose in some ways, I like to think in the not toxic ways, but in some ways it sort of suited the kind of, you know, the sort of humour I already had, I suppose, yeah.
You evolved beautifully out of that into someone who's, as far as I can tell, escaped most of the traps of masculinity. How do you look back at some of the stuff of the Lad Mags, you know, probably we're responsible for?
Well, professionally, I look back at it really fondly, because I think that the magazine industry, especially at that era, was just like a wonderful thing to be involved in terms of, A, the sort of opportunities it gave me professionally and just personally, because, you know, it was great fun. It was great fun. Magazines were selling a lot. If you were involved in that industry, you know, you got a lot of opportunities to do amazing things, to travel, to meet incredible people like your heroes, to go on adventures. It was extraordinary. And you know, and it, whilst it wasn't like necessarily the best paid area of the media, you got to sort of at times live the lifestyle of someone who earned a salary that was a lot bigger when you were quite young in your 20s, because people loved men's magazines then, because they sold a lot of issues, you know. But creatively as well, I just, you know, I was a magazine fanatic long before I got to work in magazines. I just thought they were amazing. And I thought all the people that I worked with, you know, having subsequently worked in lots of different areas of the media, they remain the sort of most inspiring creative people I work with. And I think that now people look back on that era and probably define it by its most extreme examples of kind of Lad Mags, where they became very toxic and problematic portrayals of women and so forth. And so it's difficult to sort of always defend that. But I think it does the sort of publishing boom of that sort of the 90s to noughties a real disservice, because I think it's populated by a lot of very smart, brilliantly creative people who made some incredible things. I think, you know, in the mid-90s to the early noughties, there were a lot of things in society and culture that were normalised and that everyone was swept up in, that you now look back on and think, wow, how did that happen? How did we just go along with those kind of weird attitudes and behaviours? Magazines, like a lot of other sort of areas of our society, were certainly involved in that.
I remember I was on, I was a teenager and I was on video games magazines when all these men's magazines started. And I remember being like, a magazine for men? It just seemed quite strangely sort of, you know, revolutionary. And you're right, there was lots of, I mean, there's loads of fun stuff that you guys would do. I remember I would be doing features like taking a Sega console to an old people's home to see what they made of the sort of shoot 'em ups. And then I would look at sort of the magazines that you guys were making, and it's like Sam's been arrested in Colombia for trying to start a Mexican cartel. And, you know, it just seemed like there was a lot of fun going on and great writing. But it was quite hardcore, it seemed like. Imagining the lives of the writers. I mean, you sort of put your body through it, not just in the adventures that you would have, but also in what seemed to be the kind of the office environment. It was a very different sounding office environment from what I was used to.
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, you know, like Phil said, I started at Men's Health, which was sort of like not like that at all. Although it was sort of part of that magazine publishing kind of boom, because it sold a huge amount of magazines and was successful and popular, but it certainly didn't subscribe to the sort of laddie lifestyle. And that was my first taste of magazines. But even there, I remember being quite surprised, having sort of only recently left university, at the sort of opportunities you got to go to parties and drink free alcohol and so forth. I found that quite alluring. I got to go on a few kind of free holidays and whatnot. And there was drinking and all the rest of that sort of stuff. And then we launched another magazine called Later, and that sort of was trying to be a bit more evolved. It was supposed to be for people who'd grown out of Loaded magazines. It was launched by the same publisher. But nevertheless, and I wouldn't say that was, I mean, I remember Loaded were upstairs in the same building. There was like proper mad, kind of seriously insane stuff, madder than the stuff they were putting in the magazine, to be honest. There was fires sometimes, and actually there was a fire in our office once as well that was started by misadventure as a result of misadventure. But I suppose it's who you compare yourself to. And that, you know, that's my life in hedonism generally. It's all about context. So we had this magazine that we thought was like a bit more evolved for the slightly older male, by which we meant at the time, hilariously, like 30-year-old, right? And and which is funny to us now, you know, the ages we're all at now, you sort of think, oh, we were trying to say this is a magazine when you've grown up and all of that stuff's behind you, you know, and you want to be responsible and have a proper job and settle down. But we thought, oh, yeah, we're not as bad as those guys upstairs doing Loaded or the people across the corridor doing NME, you know. But actually, if I look back at that time, yeah, there was a huge amount of sort of drinking and hedonism. It was only my second job, so it just seemed normal, you know. I wouldn't say we were like, I mean, you know, we had an editor who was sort of only obsessed with the gym and vegetarianism, yeah. So that kind of tempered our behaviour a little bit. But the rest of us, the rest of us were sort of like certainly making the most of the opportunities that life presented to us. And, you know, going on adventure. I remember one of the writers just pitching an idea. It's like, why don't I just try out all the drugs from the Victorian era? Just pitching that.
That's right.
Why don't I try every drug that they were into in the Victorian era? So I'll read, like, you know, Sherlock Holmes and whatnot, and we'll just list all the things that they did back then, and then I'll do them all. And the editor said, yeah, sure, great idea. And within the day, the guy was assembling somehow some Victorian drugs and taking them all. And then we did him up like a Victorian gentleman. And he literally just took all the drugs, and he just lost a few days and was just not in a good way. But it was a funny story and a funny picture. And yeah, I mean, there was lots of...
I mean, I don't know how you even do. I mean, I've been approached a few times on the streets of London and offered drugs, but if I asked for laudanum, you know...
I don't really know what they'd say. I don't know how he got it. He was I won't name him because, you know, it would be indiscreet, although he did go on record doing it. There was a picture of him taking these drugs, right? So let's just call him Simon. And and he was an extremely resourceful journalist who tracked down all these drugs and took them all very quickly once he'd been given the green light.
We did celebrate that kind of masculine excess. It was our heroes would have been Oliver Reed and people. A lot of them now would be seen as damaged and addicts, but they were kind of heroes, weren't they? We put them on the cover. That aspect of what we did, I do look back on and think, what were we doing? It didn't occur to me.
Yeah. I think that the hedonism and the glorification of that kind of life, to me now, as someone who sort of struggled with addictions and stuff and has come out the other side, and I look at it now and I just think it was just naive. You know, I don't think, oh, it was wrong, it was awful, I regret it. But I just think it was so naive to have thought that men who were living that kind of life were experience an incredible life, which is what we certainly would have said. We would have said, these are the people who've really lived life to the full. That would have been the phrase. They've lived a really great life. You know, they've filled it full of great experiences. And you just sort of think, no, they were really damaged people who actually lived quite small lives that were defined just by their own private addictions. And I just look back and think how peculiar that all the things and the people that we celebrated were basically defined by their addictions and the dark sides and the not pleasant parts of themselves, you know. I wouldn't say I regret it because I can understand where it came from, but I just sort of think what a shame that I didn't see life in a clearer way, you know, and that we were just sort of swept along in sort of, you know, spreading that kind of idea of masculinity as being aspirational.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because you think of the Oliver Reeves and George Best would probably be another example. And kind of as a reader then, I was kind of seduced by all that as well and thinking, yeah, amazing. You know, and he spends all his time doing this. But like you say, it is quite a small life where it's kind of limited to the pubs that will be delighted that you're there because they've bought into it as well. And it's kind of a badge of honour for them to have George Best propping up the bar. Or it's really his kitchen, isn't it? It's his kitchen at breakfast time and it's his kitchen at night time and it's sleeping on the sofa. Yeah. And none of that looks as good on a cover. But that sort of that kind of bravado. I mean, I read in your, you know, I'm a keen reader of The Reset, your brilliant newsletter, which is all to do with, thanks. It's mental health without the bollocks is the kind of thing you sort of describe it as. And there's a paragraph I thought was interesting, which was about you. In the pub on a Saturday, we were all so filled with the four Bs of the professional geezer. Bravado, bullshit, booze, and bugle. We were so eager to make each other laugh and just block out the shit that made us anxious during the week, we became experts at presenting ourselves as freewheeling, carefree, laugh-a-minute legends. And this was, you know, with your own social group. These were people that you've grown up with, but there was still kind of that, well, as you say, that kind of bravado.
Yeah, just sort of bullshitting each other all of the time. As a means of distraction from all of the things that might have been bothering us that we couldn't quite find a way to confront or talk about, and that we would have been ashamed of as well, and we would have also thought it'd be really boring. You had a binary choice between being that guy or being a really boring weirdo who's constantly on about his feelings, right? And you sort of thought it's a choice, which guy are you going to be? Obviously, I'm going to be a legend, you know? And just seeing, you know, your sort of choices of your personality as so binary and so, you know, so limited. You know, all those guys who I was probably referring to, I've just got back from Germany with them. We all went away, same group I've been going with since I was an adolescent. And now we're all in our 40s, some of us in our 50s. And we went to Germany for a couple of days to watch our team, West Ham. And a couple of us are sort of very much, you know, regulars at Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous or what have you. Some of us, maybe one or two, are still at it as almost as hard as they were when they were younger. And another couple probably just sort of like just calm down. They still drink, but they're, you know, kind of managed to sort of control all those impulses. But the wonderful thing is that I still have just as much of a laugh. I what you discover is that you get a much keener sense of what you actually do and don't enjoy. So when I say it's quite a limited life for your George Best or Oliver Reed, I think now that when you're drinking or taking drugs, the feelings are the same no matter what you are doing, right? Because the sensation of being drunk is the sensation of being drunk. ultimately, whether you're sat at home in front of the TV or you're out, you know, at a football match or wherever else you want to get drunk, or you're at a party, drunkenness sort of is the same feeling. And you don't really get a sense of what you actually like and don't like. So Christmas is a good example of that. You know, when I had my first sober Christmas, you know, since childhood, I was like, oh, yeah, Christmas is amazing. But I kind of wasted every Christmas by associating it only with being like really, really drunk. And then I'm just in my drunk world, which is just the same as being drunk on any other day of the year. I have the same feelings inside of me. Whereas now I kind of really appreciate Christmas. It's the same with football. You know, I went to football and actually all the raucousness that I still enjoy and get swept up in, you know, of the being together with a big bunch of fans, everyone's singing and having a laugh and everyone's having a drink. And I'm not having a drink. I'm having a coffee or whatever, or a Coke. But I don't care. I'm still singing and having a great laugh because it's a laugh, until it isn't. At which point I got in a taxi from the town square, drove back to my hotel and had a sleep for an hour, then had a shower, got changed and went back out and met them later for the game. The difference is, when I was drinking and taking drugs, all it did was make you think, this has stopped being fun, but I can keep going anyway, thanks to drinking drugs. So I have a much keener sense now of basically things that I like in life and things that I don't like.
Coming up on Monatomy.
I remember just one day thinking, oh, I know what I could do. I could just take cocaine. If I take cocaine, it will just mean that I can just sober up and work through the day and maybe the whole night. And then I'll get all my work done.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
One of the things I love about The Reset and the way you write about men and mental health is it sort of, for me, draws the curtain aside on what appears to be that lad persona where you haven't got a care in the world. Because I could never do that performance the way you could. I don't like football. It's not my kind of thing. And I would see a group of blokes and think, you're having a fantastic time and I can't join in. And you sort of pulled the curtain aside on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really what I want to do, is that, you know, you don't have to be one thing or the other, you know. But every Jack the Lad in the pub who has built everything about their persona into appearing to be, you know, carefree and not taking anything seriously and nothing matters with them and everything's the water off a duck's back, that is a myth. There is no human being who operates like that, you know. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter your level of education or anything. No, that, you know, every human has got all the same little bits of pain or fear or shame or any of this stuff that we deal with. I think that everyone learns at a pretty early age in their own way to pretend to be okay, right? Everyone learns to be okay. It's a sort of a thing, but people do it in different ways. I think even kids do. I think kids like to pretend to their parents that they're okay. I can remember when I was a kid, I was from a broken home, and there was quite a lot of like chaos and emotional disruption. And I remember all the time reassuring both my mum and my dad that I was fine. And I just totally wasn't. Of course I wasn't. It was at times it was hell. But my biggest priority at times was to reassure the adults in my life that they were doing a good job and I was in fact okay, right? And I think loads of people do that in whatever, not everyone's from that, you know, a broken home or whatever, but everyone has shit when they're a kid, and people learn really quick to pretend to be okay. And then as I got older, yeah, the lad persona was a brilliant disguise for pretending to be okay, because it was fun. And I write that in the reset all the time. I go, look, I'm not going to lie. Being a Jack the Lad's a right laugh, right? And that's why I still do it, even though I'm now sober and a little bit more open about my vulnerabilities. It's not that it only existed as a facade. There's fun to be had if that happens to be your cup of tea and you know, sort of thing you like or the sort of thing you grew up in. But you can also say, yeah, all this stuff is a laugh. I was out in Frankfurt last week. I was on a table singing and shouting and all the rest of it, right? But it made no difference to me to be able to the next minute probably weird some poor bloke out, because when he asked me why I'm drinking a coffee, I go, oh, I'm alcoholic, mate. I was a complete pisshead. I think I did it to numb out feelings I've had since childhood. And people go, whoa, okay. Like that. I do that all the time. I actually get quite a lot of pleasure out of it. I've been on a few European adventures this year watching West Ham. And I was on a train and there was a bunch of quite pissed up lads in Spain and they were sitting in my seat, one of them. And I said, I said, you're in my seat. And they went, ah, don't worry, mate. We're all West Ham. Sit with us and have a few beers. Anyway, sit with us in another seat and have a few beers. And they were really leery and loud. And I went, no, you're right. I said, what I'll do is I'll sit back there and I'll have a kip. And they go, why? What's the matter? Like, you know, they were being a bit funny. I went, well, you lot are all on the piss. I said, no, I'm not drinking. I just want to sleep. Why aren't you drinking? I said, I'm teetotal. Why? I said, yeah, I was a pisshead and a cokehead, mate. I said, it was off the scale. And they went, oh, are you? Oh, that's interesting. And then they just wanted to, like, talk to me about it for ages, you know, and they were sort of disarmed by it, sort of thing. And I quite like it. I quite like people are so curious, you know. And I did end up sitting with them and having a cup of coffee for a certain amount of time. And then when I got bored because they were too drunk and repeating themselves, I just told them, I'm a bit bored now. I'm going to go and have a sleep over there. And they seem to respect it.
Yeah, it's the freedom of honesty, isn't it? It's like you're the first to say it. And so you just get to get it out there. When you said when you were a kid, you know, that quite identifiable thing that I hadn't really thought about before, when you are reassuring a grown-up that you're okay. Why do you think we do that? Is it because we don't want to talk about it? We don't want to make a fuss of it. We don't want to reveal whatever it is. Why would we hide it from our parents?
I'm not entirely sure, but I did interview for the reset a really interesting bloke called Richard Beard, and you might have seen his book. It was called Sad Little Men.
Yes.
And it was about the experience of going to boarding school, which is something you know, none of us did, but it was really insightful because in it he writes about how by sending him to boarding school, his parents had effectively withdrawn their love. That's how it appeared to him. And therefore, he puts excerpts of his letters home when he's like 11 at a school where he remembers vividly just having a rubbish time and feeling really miserable. But all of his letters home just keep telling his mum how great it is and how grateful he is that she's made the sacrifices to send him there. And wow. He writes, it's like your parents withdraw their love, right? Or at least that's what you might perceive it as. And as a kid, all you want to do is chase it. You don't think, ah, I don't care about that. You know, you think, oh my God, I need to get their love back. I'm gonna love bomb them. Do you know what I mean? And I don't, yeah. I'm not saying like my parents withdrew their love from me. My parents were very loving, but the situation that I was in did make me feel a little bit lost and a bit neglected, right? Not by design, I don't suppose, but I think everyone probably has periods like that in their childhood that they remember. And I think in a way, you're trying, it's a way of sucking up to your parents. You're doing a great job, guys. I just want to say you are doing, it's like an underperforming team, right? It's like, you know, Phil, you're a manager. You've been a manager many a times. You might have an underperforming team and you can either put a rocket up them. In football, you go, you either, some lads need a rocket up their ass, some need a hand on the shoulder, right? And I suppose in management, you have to work that out. And I think when you're a kid, with your parents, you don't put a rocket up their ass and go, guys, this is bullshit. You've broken up. You're toying with me emotionally. I live in a state of complete chaos and insecurity. You've got to shape up. What you actually do is like, guys, you're doing a great job. I believe in you. I absolutely believe in both of you. And I know and believe you're going to go to even better things in your parenting over the coming months and years. And I just want to say well done, right? I think that's what I was doing. I think that's what kids do. They're trying to sort of reassure their parents to try and get a better performance out of them, maybe. Maybe that's it.
Wow.
I'm coming at this as a parent of adult children now, and I'm realizing that every conversation I have with them is basically, tell me I'm doing okay and you're okay.
Yeah.
Disguised as, what have you seen that movie and how did football go? Mm. You're okay, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I do that. I mean, there's a meme that which is Pick Me Girl, right? Which is an image of a girl who's very needy, right? And my daughter, who's 14, calls me Pick Me Dad, right? Because she says, you're like the Pick Me Girl, but you're a dad and you're really needy and you need to be told the whole time that you're a good dad. You want to be liked, not just by me, but my friends. Also true. I want all of our friends to think I'm a funny, cool dad, right? And I want to be reassured constantly. And the fact that she refuses to reassure me in many ways makes me feel that she's quite well adjusted. Because it means she's not doing that thing and pretending to be okay. So maybe, in fact, the fact that she often tells me that I'm actually underperforming as a parent should be reassuring to me, because she's got the confidence to do that, you know?
It shows you've done a good job. Yeah, exactly. It's your little hand on the shoulder, isn't it? But with probably some quite disparaging remarks. You mentioned, you know, addiction and also, you know, being a family man. The two don't go well together a lot of the time. And you've written a lot and very powerfully, I think, about, you know, booze and about how in everyday family life you would be, if you were working, you'd be maybe finding hidden miniatures of vodka and that gets you through the day, and maybe doing lines when your wife was in a different room, and at family get-togethers, smuggling cans in your jumper to get to the bathroom so you could chug them down. And you write really powerfully about the day your wife called you out on your drinking, which was, I suppose, the moment that you needed.
Yeah, I guess so. But I hesitate from saying, oh, there was this big moment, because I think a lot of people who are struggling with bad habits wait for a moment to come along and they think there will be a moment. Right. And people often say to you, ah, what was the moment? Because people are secretly hoping for it, right? Ah, did your wife give you an ultimatum? Was that what drove you finally to get help? And I think, well, kind of, but no. And, you know, the cliche is true that you only really do it when you kind of really want to do it. And like the ultimatum thing, certainly when she had got to a stage where she's like crying because she could see, she'd woken up, gone down to make tea, and she could see that like the bottle of vodka that had been almost full the night before. And then she'd gone to bed and I said, I'm just staying up to watch, you know, the Europa League highlights or whatever bullshit thing I said I was watching on this telly, you know, and in fact, I just polished it off. And then she would cry. She cried over breakfast a couple of times. You think, oh God. And that, but that just, that kind of obviously is very powerful, because it's someone you love and care about so much, you think this is really just messed up now. I'm making her miserable. But still, I've got to be honest, it's not, you know, I didn't do it for her. I didn't really, you know, I did it. I that was one of the sort of catalysts, but there was a number of different catalysts. And in the end, you just have to think, I just don't want to be like this anymore for a number of different reasons, that being one of the most significant. And so you go and get help, but yeah, I don't think there was like, I didn't have like a rock bottom or one big sort of defining moment where you think enough's enough. It all kind of comes together over a period where you just think, I can't do this anymore. But yeah, I mean, obviously your wife crying over breakfast is not a pleasant experience.
One aspect of your addiction that's always interested me is you tied it in with work productivity, because I'm kind of obsessed with I feel I need to work all the time, and if I'm awake I should be working in some form or another. And you've described this tangling up with your addiction issues. Could you talk about that? Because I think loads of people would learn from it.
I think that, you know, I'd always been someone who drank a fair amount and dabbled in drugs. But like I say, it was all about context. So when I was adolescent, then when I was older and working in the media, I never thought of myself as someone who was kind of anywhere near problematic, largely because, you know, it's that classic thing, everyone else around me, whether I was at work, working on magazines or later in the radio or TV, or whether I was at football with my old mates from there, or with my brothers even, you know, and old childhood mates. I was never even in the top four. I wasn't even in the Champions League places in any social situation. So it really sort of crept up on me. The thing is if you're just, if you're doing it on any level on a regular basis, it can really creep up on you because, you know, you before you know it, you might start using it as a tool. And I think in my mid-30s, I was completely overwhelmed with the combination of work responsibilities and family responsibilities. And I had, you know, I lost all sight of basically balance in my life. I was, you know, sort of had quite young children. I was still fairly young, new to fatherhood. I was obsessed with like, oh my God, I've got these responsibilities. So I have to say yes to every single piece of work that comes my way. I will juggle it. I will find a way. Thinking that that made me a good dad. That was the justification. It was unsustainable for me personally. It was just, I got myself into a situation where it was just completely unsustainable, the sort of stuff I was attempting to do in my life. Because I was attempting not just to do way too much work, and it wasn't like I had one job and that was a very busy job. There was a period where I had like three or four different jobs. It was like, and I was, it was like a farce. I was trying to juggle them all without people knowing. I was working at a TV station in a sort of an executive role. And I was literally saying, I'm going out for a bit for a lunch. And I would get on my scooter and go to the opopposite side of London to present a 3-hour radio show on TalkSport and then come back. Right. That was in Waterloo. The TV company I was working with was in Camden Town. So if you know London, you'll know that's south to north. I'd jump back on the scooter, come back and sort of imply to the people I work with, oh, yeah, lunch really overran. And then I went to another meeting. I've been on air. I had to bank on the fact they never had TalkSport on in the office. So it's just stupid. You know, it was just stupid. But I thought, I've got to do all of this stuff. I've got to do all of this stuff all the time. And I started in that period to sort of drink more in the day. And then when I was drinking more in the day, it was sort of unsustainable because I'm the sort of person who always got very, very sleepy when I drank. And so then I just sort of, it's like I'd sort of dabbled in cocaine since I was like a teenager, but never really had a problem. I remember just one day thinking, oh, I know what I could do. I could just take cocaine. Like as if it was just some like, how had I never thought that before? If I take cocaine, it will just mean that I can just sober up and work through the day and maybe the whole night. And then I'll get all my work done. And it was like I'd just discovered, you know, that film, a film that I was obsessed with was that film. What's that film with Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro where he takes a special pill?
Limitless. And it makes, we love it. Limitless. Yeah.
What a movie, right? But yeah. I was obsessed with it. But now I blame it for a lot. Now I would say, don't watch that film and think it's aspirational, right? Because since I kind of got better, so to speak, and, you know, I'm sort of almost 7 years sober now. One of the biggest lessons I learned in a really simple way is, do you know what? Just rest. Just rest. Mm-hmm. Just let go of the grind culture, as they call it now. Let go of the idea that you've got to be doing all of these things all the time. I have a phrase which is glamorize rest, right? So resting is the sort of thing that in my old life I would have thought was like, resting, that's like failure. Do you know what I mean? It means you must have nothing to do. And having nothing to do means you're kind of unwanted, right? Or you're just not. And now I just think the successes in my life, I've taught myself to feel great when I like have a nap in the day, which I try to do a lot, right? I mean, you know, I'll have like 3-4 naps a week, daytime naps, yeah? And I feel superb about that. I feel that's the real life. If I, in a way, it's like I used to, you know, if you look for like fictional characters that you should aspire to be, it's like Bertie Wooster, right? Bertie Wooster was like a layabout. I mean, he was financed by aunties and whatnot, right? Which I am not, right? And not many people are. But if you can sort of, that's aspirational to me. I like to work and I like to be creative, but now I'm so much more discerning about what I do and don't do. I'm so much happier. I can happily live with less money if I have to. Although very often, you know, the new approach and attitudes that I now have towards work has meant happily that very often, you know, I'm doing better than I used to be, because I'm not as overstretched. I'm much more focused in the things I do. So it's a very practical change once I got completely sober, which was me personally, I was just overstretching myself. I was putting way too much pressure on myself mentally. I was trying to be a different sort of a dad to like my dad or many other sort of like older role models I'd had in my life growing up, right? So people who were like really into their work and their careers and sort of had a badge of honour by saying that, I don't know, they had a nanny, or they'd say things like horrible things like, oh, leave all that to the missus as a boast, right, about the way they approach childcare. Or like, I had a mate who used to go, huh, kids' parties. I don't do kids' parties. The wife knows that. All this stuff. And I always had a sense of that being sort of somehow awful, that you would boast about how neglectful you were to your family. But there's a lot of guys who did that. I think there's less now. But certainly a lot of the guys who I grew up around, who were older than me and had kids before me, were like sort of boastful about how neglectful they were. It's not how they would phrase it, but it's the way that I saw it. And I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be there. I wanted to be around. So if you combine that, I'm going to put a shift in and be a really good dad, and I'm going to do all the kids' parties, and I'm going to be Santa Claus at Christmas, which I was. I mean, probably off my face in retrospect. I can't quite remember, but it would have made for a good performance. But like, you know, like, yeah. So I was trying to put in the best possible shift as a dad, whilst also putting huge pressure on myself to do all of these things in work, both for practical reasons, but also to do with my ego and wanting to be perceived as a success and all of that sort of stuff. And those things all together meant that I couldn't cope. Maybe some people can. I couldn't mentally, emotionally, or physically cope with the amount I was trying to take on. And therefore, I turned to drugs and alcohol, thinking that, oh, like in a mad way, thinking, oh, this will be fine. I'll just use this to get through all of this. It's no problem at all. But it's a massive problem, you know. It's absolutely massive. It completely takes over. It's not like taking a, you know, thinking I've got a headache, I'll just take a paracetamol, you know. And I genuinely think that Limitless had a bad effect on me, right? I do. I think I watched Limitless, and like a lot of blokes who watched it when it came out thought, that's amazing, right? The bit where he's running through Central Park learning Japanese. Look, I'm looking at Phil because I've known Phil for long enough to know that that's probably his favourite scene in the film, right?
No. Nothing's right? Better than... I mean, I regularly now try and take on 7 or 8 men in a subway at the sort of mixed martial arts, and I just move very slowly, but it never works out for me. Because you've known Sam so well, I've you know known Sam for a long time, but not known Sam. You really know Sam. And did you notice any of this? Did it concern you, or was it just part of who he was? Like, it didn't occur to you?
No. Well, you were very good, as you say, at that, putting on the show of being okay. I mean, you're world class, I think, at putting on the show of being okay. You always seemed a lot more happy and well adjusted than I did, whilst not being addicted to drugs and to drugs and booze. But there was a slight, I suppose, if I'm honest, there'd be a slight mania sometimes when we went out drinking, where you drink at twice the speed that everyone else would, and just. But I often put that down, and I'd be interested to ask you about it in a Limitless theme, because you've got a massive fast brain. And I just wondered if you needed some of that boost to just damp it down a bit to make life livable.
Yeah, maybe sometimes. I mean, they do say that creative people are very, like, sometimes, you know, prone to addiction, because sometimes it's just your own thought patterns might bother you. And I've always been extremely anxious, very anxious ever since childhood, like always worrying. But if you saw me appearing not to be worried, that was because at that moment I wouldn't, because a good outlet for me was to be in social situations and be loud or try to make people laugh or have a drink, because I'd think that's respite for me, and I'd go really hard at it because it would just, the whole thing would just be respite, you know, from like the constant anxieties and worries that would swirl in my mind at other times when I was perhaps alone or bored or lonely. And so it wasn't necessarily an act. It was more just sort of like I'd go really hard at being a sociable person because I'd always had just, yeah, really, really, really bad anxiety. And that was one other thing I think that was behind my drinking getting out of control is that I had got depressed, particularly in my 30s. I had got depressed and anxious in a really severe way, like for the first time in my adult life where it really like knocked me out like for 6 months or so, like really, really depressed and just like a like I'd been hit by a train. I didn't know where it had come from and nothing. And every morning I woke up thinking, maybe today's the day I'll feel better. Because sometimes if you've been through those sort of times in your life, which so many of us have, you wake up and for the first like 10 to 30 seconds of waking up after a decent night's sleep, you sort of feel all right. And then suddenly you remember, oh no, I'm not all right. I'm really depressed. Oh, but maybe it's gone. Oh no, shit, it's still there. And it went on for months and months. And then eventually, for a variety of reasons, it went. And then it happened again. And then when I got really into drinking and taking too many drugs, again, I sort of felt like that black dog was after me, right? And whenever I saw little warning signs, I would go even harder into the things that seemed to help. Drink, drugs, football, going out, mucking around, whatever. I'd run much, much harder into those things because I was so terrified of that black dog coming back again. Because I'd had two experiences, both of which had lasted several months, a year apart, in my mid-30s. And I was like, when it got to my late-30s, it was like, nothing is worse than that. Nothing has been as bad in my life. I didn't know where it had come from either time. I do now. I think I was just always overstretched and exhausted and just wasn't sort of being nice to myself. But yeah, I think that like being that kind of larger than life person, which I know I am, very noisy person, that is just a good distraction for me. It still is really.
There's a moment that you write about that sort of takes in a lot of that stuff and also I suppose led you to understand that you need to slow down and to celebrate resting, like you say, celebrate having a packet of crisps and watching a film or celebrate the naps. But it came from a time when you couldn't rest. You would feel guilty or anxious if you had a spare day because you thought, well, everyone else is working. Why aren't I working? And then you thought, well, I'll take the ball. I'll do something with this day that other people can't do. People in office jobs can't do. I'm going to go to IKEA and I'm going to buy those light bulbs that you can only get at IKEA. And so you went to IKEA. And we all have a bad time at IKEA, but you had a terrible time at IKEA where it seemed like the universe sort of crashed in on you.
Yeah, it just triggered me so badly. So badly. I read a good line, actually, in a book only today that he was talking about. It's a book that's coming out soon about someone who had to basically step out of their life and successful career and all the rest of it to basically become a full-time carer to their parents. And, you know, it's about the sort of experiences of loneliness and isolation that sort of consumed that person. And the line he said was is that I just wanted to feel like a participant in life as opposed to a passenger, right? It made me feel a bit of a dickhead because this person is writing about something very real that happened to them that consumed all of their life and did sort of effectively take them out of being an active participant, so to speak. Whereas I had just gone to IKEA, but that phrase spoke to me quite a lot because it's something that I think that I've always used to be anxious about. I sort of just thought there's shit going on somewhere that's important and exciting and relevant. And if I'm not near that, I feel like I'm failing and that I am a pathetic, lazy waster. And it didn't take long for me to fall into those sort of thoughts about myself, those self-criticisms. And different things can trigger it. But yeah, that really did trigger it. A trip to IKEA. There's a, you know, the desolate nature of a car park in Wembley on like a Tuesday, grey Tuesday. Do you know what I mean? Where actually at other times in your life, a Tuesday might have constituted stuff that seemed quite exciting and productive and glamorous. And suddenly you're like, what am I doing here in the middle of bloody Wembley on a Tuesday afternoon buying light bulbs? This is disastrous. And then you just read so much into it. And it's basically, yeah, it's just self critical voices in your head, but they come from a sort of a phony idea that you have of yourself, or that I had of myself, of what I should be and what I should aspire to be. It was completely warped. Who knows where I picked it up? I mean, God, I probably had picked it up from working on men's magazines or whatever. I don't know. I wasn't raised religious or anything. I had no spiritual advice whatsoever. I just had sort of a, you watched Minder and went to the football and, you know, picked up bits and bobs from like older male relatives, maybe. I don't know. It's total nonsense. It's madness that you've just pieced together in a really jumbled, non-strategic way. But then you hold yourself to it, you know, so strictly. And if you don't kind of live up to it in any small way, you hate yourself and bully yourself and just like are so horrible and mean to yourself that you actually just like end up kind of bullying yourself into a state of depression and anxiety over it. You know, that's what I did that day in IKEA. And it lasted for about 3 or 4 months. That was a big problem. And then, you know, again, post-sobriety, what sobriety does is, you know, once you, the first bit is you just stop putting bad stuff inside your body. But that's like quite a small bit. The next bit is you start reassessing and reflecting on all this stuff that you haven't done. To a large extent, you stop doing it the day you start getting off your face, right? Which for me was about 12 years old, you know. And that is the point. A lot of people will say, that's the point at which you stop emotionally evolving, because that's the point at which you learn that your response to any difficult emotions or feelings is basically drink or drugs or something like that, right? You start learning ways to quickly distract yourself. And so you've done no reflecting, no confronting, no really thinking, who do I want to be and how do I achieve that, right? And also, how do I deal with this negative thing that's happened to me? Process it and move on. You bury all that stuff from the moment you start, you know, distracting yourself with drink and drugs. I was smoking weed and drinking alcohol, you know, every weekend from the age of 12. And then I was, when I was 40, I got sober and I started going through all of that stuff that had made me feel anxious and worried about myself and insecure and ashamed of myself for many years. I started, you know, becoming, confronting that, slowly becoming more comfortable with it, then moving it aside. And at the same time, developing a new idea of who I really wanted to be, who I should be. And it was in many ways much easier and more attainable than the mad, warped, perverted idea that I had had throughout my 20s and 30s of who I should be.
Danny, you're a creative and you've had a lot of Tuesdays and a lot of opportunities to go to our kids. And any of this mean anything to you? Because you've always led that life as long as I've known you.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. You know, I related to a lot of that. Not no way is kind of extreme, but definitely that discomfort, that guilt, that feeling like I'd always been very, 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 very busy. And then you have kids and then you're concentrating on those type of things. And then when the kids are at school or something and you haven't got something to fill a day, or there isn't the next thing, that's the thing. We move kind of, a lot of us, from project to project. And when you've finished a project, it's like when you're at school, right? And you've done the school play and all you've done is rehearse and rehearse and rehearse for the school play. And then you do it for 2 nights. And then you're such a high on the second night. And everyone's like, you were a great Mr. Sourberry. I was Mr. Sourberry and Oliver. It's the only role they always edit out of all the film versions. So no one knows what it
is.
I don't know
him, but it's a great name.
Yeah. And then the next day, there is no play. There is nothing to sort of fill your life. It's that times kind of 1,000. And yes. I'm definitely guilty of using wine to stop thinking, you know, to dampen down thoughts sometimes, to signal the end of the bit where either you have been working all day and now it's over, or you haven't been working all day and there's nothing to sort of differentiate any of it. So you mark the end of that. That's gone. And it's, you know, it's not a good thing. I'm listening to Sam and I'm reading all his stuff and I'm learning a lot and questioning a lot about my own behavior as well. So so I thank you for that, Sam.
Well, I'm glad. What I'm not trying to say to anyone is, by the way, is, oh, you can only do this stuff without alcohol or drugs. You know, plenty of people drink perfectly in a perfectly healthy way. That happened to be something that I allowed to get out of hand, and so I can't do it anymore, and I don't want to. But I think it, you know, for other people it's different things, but it's all distraction, pretending to be okay, I think, you know, you can stop pretending to be okay. You can acknowledge that you might feel shit. That can be hard for blokes like us to do. If you have a lot of like inherent things that give you a lot of advantages, right? So all of us sitting here, the colour of our skin and our gender alone gives us a lot of advantages. If you are, particularly if you're sort of a liberal minded sort of a person, you can put even, you know, you can be even harder on yourself in terms of how could I possibly ever allow myself to feel bad or sad about anything when my life is so full of privilege, right? And that's a real problem for a lot of dads, I think, because, you know, it means that you're comparing to other people who've got it a lot worse, which people, of course, do. You'll always find someone who've got it a lot worse, and therefore forbidding yourself to acknowledge that it doesn't really matter what other people are going through. You are feeling pain or shame, discomfort, anxiety, all of the other things. You're knackered, you're bored, you feel lonely, whatever it is. You're just shitting yourself about a bill you can't pay. You know, this is stuff that you need to actually think, yeah, this is tough and I need to do something about, you know, I need to be a bit nicer to myself and acknowledge that it's tough. And so, yeah, so what although I was saying, oh, the big turning point for me was not drinking. I don't think it's necessary for everyone to do that. But I do think it's good for everyone to sort of learn to maybe sit a bit more with their feelings. Do you know what I mean? And not necessarily always distract themselves from it in whatever way they do.
Still to come on Monatomy.
And I leant forward and I went, mate, change your plan. Take me to Trumpers. And he went, oh, all right. And it's like something from a film. He sort of pulled a Yui.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I have to ask you about your hair because we've all gone bald, but when you had hair, you had the most amazing hair ever. How do you feel about it now?
Yeah, I had trademark hair. Like when I was in my late teens, I really struggled with my hair until I got to about like 18, and then I grew it, and it was very much of the Britpop era, and it was big and larger than life, and yeah, I was quite pleased with it for a few years, but I have to say, I noticed before other people, I knew what was going on behind the scenes, right? Like when I got out of the show, I thought this is not going to last. I'll try not to think about it again, distracting myself. And then there was some tough years where it was much more obvious that it was thinning. But, you know, taking the leap to thinking I'm just going to have it all off is a massive thing. And that is bald men tend to be pretty good at laughing about their own baldness. I try to be. I know you are, right? But the truth is that when you're first going bald and you know that there's no turning back, the truth is it is actually really horrible for your mental health. It really is, right? And I remember I would go on like once a week. I did this thing where I reviewed the newspapers on Sky News in the morning, and it used to be bags of fun. And you know, you'd come off air and then you'd straight away look at your Twitter like you do, like, let's see if anyone's praising me, right? And I used to get like, you know, quite a lot of praise, few people slagging me off for what I'd said, but quite a lot of people praying. I'd be like, great. And then over the years, I did it for years, over the years I started to notice that like the praise was being almost matched by the amount of people saying, mate, you look at the state of your barnet, give it up, shave it off. And I was like getting pretty upset, you know. And And one day I was going along in a taxi, having done that in the morning. I was then in the centre of town going to a meeting in a taxi. And I can't remember the exact wording of this tweet I got, but I was in the back of this cab and the tweet was so mean about my thinning hair and how it was quite apparent that I was trying and failing to cover it up by combing it strategically, which was true, right? That you just got, why don't you just do it? It's pathetic. You're an embarrassment. It was such a mean thing. And I went, oh, God. And I literally leant forward to the cabbie and I said, take me to the barbers. And the barbers was Trumpers in Mayfair. I don't know if you know it, but it's like a very old, it's a really old, and I've never been there, right? But I knew that I was nearby in a taxi and I'd always been fascinated to go there because it's a really old fashioned like barber shop. Not one of these ones that pretends to be old fashioned that you get now. This was like, this is the real deal. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. And I leant forward and I went, mate, change your plan. Take me to Trumpers. And he went, oh, all right. And it's like something from a film. He sort of pulled a Yui in a dramatic way. And I jumped out and I went in and it was the only female barber in there. She was an older woman. I'm not sure what European accent she had, but I remember being really kind about it. And I was really honest with her. I sat down and said, just take it off. And she was like, why? It's a big decision for you. Why? And I said, because look, and I think I read it to her. I said, I've had enough of this. Oh, no. It's just embarrassing. Everyone can see what's happening, right? And I just can't, I'm scared to see what I look like, but let's just do it and find out. And she was so nice. She went, you'll never need to worry because you have such a lovely face. You have a lovely face. Oh. It doesn't matter what's on your head. And she grabbed my face in both, she cupped it in both hands and said, look at that face. And she made me feel wonderful. And then she took the air off and it was all right. And I've never looked back. And I actually happened to think that I'm grateful for what you said, Phil, about my good hair that I had. But I actually happen to think I am more handsome without hair. And going back to me being quite a needy person, I have asked several women, both ones like my wife, my daughter, but also just women I work with or whatever, I've asked them in a very leading question sort of way when I've shown the picture of me with it. Do you think I'm more handsome now? And they've all said yes, apart from, of course, my wife and daughter, who just say, no, you look like an idiot now. And in my daughter's case, you go, you look like an idiot now and you look like an idiot then as well.
But I love the way you use London. It's like you jump on scooters, you go north to south, you're in black cabs, so yeah. Take me to Trumpers. You're like some, it is like some dandy in the 60s, some sort of, it is a Bertie Wooster lifestyle. So that leads us then to the question of how you will want to be seen. It's the perfect sort of lead-in, because in the middle of London, they've just decided to erect a giant Sam Delaney statue. And it's going to be enormous, and you are allowed to talk to the sculptor and say, you know, I take a bit off here, add a bit here, whatever it is. I'm guessing the haunches will figure highly. But then, will it be Sam with hair? Will it be Sam without hair? How will you be seen?
Definitely bald. Don't want hair. Statue hair is difficult to pull off anyway, especially the sort of hairstyle I had, which is quite long and shaggy. I can't see anyone chiseling that, right? But I genuinely prefer myself bald. And I think it's harder when you get older. I'm 47 to sort of sustain dignity with a hairstyle, right? That's what I tell myself anyway. And so, because it's like, where'd you go? I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know what I'd ask a barber now. You know, you don't want to go. Anyway, I'd definitely be bald. Would I be naked? Yeah, because the best statues are. So I'm quite happy with my frame in that I'm sort of quite tall and sort of traditionally was quite lean, but now I've got a gut. So I'll just get them to get rid of that. Give me a six pack, which is something I have never and will never have. And I'd cover my modesty with something. I'd go for a Greek god look. And I'd be happy with the haunches if I was naked as well. Because actually, you know, I'd rather have like Stuart Pearce haunches than Charles Hawtrey ones, you know. So yeah, and I, you know, and I'm very pale, so nude, very unpleasant to look at, I think. Partly because I'm so pasty, right? So I'd sort of want it to be like a bronze statue or something like that, because that's quite a big insecurity of mine, is my sort of porridgey complexion. So, yeah, my gut, and my complexion are the two things that I would ask them to work on hardest. But you know, my face, I'm all right with my face. It's a strange, peculiar face, but it's like sort of, I think it's quite memorable. So I'm all right with that.
Yeah. Well, we'll get that straight down to the sculptor. Sam, it's been brilliant. You've been so honest and so funny and so wise. And I've learned a lot. And, you know, we can't thank you enough, right, Phil?
Thanks so much. Absolutely brilliant. And I'm always learning from you. And that was, I'm going to go away and ask myself a few serious questions as a result of that. That was brilliant.
Thanks so much for having me, lads. Cheers.
I thought that was a great chat with Sam Delaney. Our thanks to him, Phil.
What a man. I feel I'm learning from him. It's great to learn from someone who's much younger than you. He's been on this extraordinary journey of self-exploration to get himself straight and off the booze and off the drugs and explore what makes him anxious and occasionally depressed. And I'm miles behind. I don't know where you are on this, but the way he talks about himself, I'm thinking, yeah, this is the... I've got to start on that journey at least and work out what makes me tick. I don't have those addiction problems, but I could definitely be a better person and more along Sam lines.
Yeah, me too. And I think that the way the sentences just kind of flow from him, he's obviously given all of this so much thought and self-reflection, but is such a great communicator that it's like he turns on the hosepipe and out comes the experience and the wisdom. So our thanks hugely to Sam. And he is running 100K in May for Ukraine, isn't he? There's a Just Giving there.
There's a Just Giving there. If you go onto the Reset, you can find all the details. I've donated, and that's a lot of K in a
it's
month.
Too many K.
So you've got to support him.
Yeah, absolutely. So Google Sam Delaney, The Reset, and you will find him. So before we tell you who's on next time, give us a review if you like the show. It helps new people find us. And our twice-weekly newsletter can be found at manatomy.co.uk. It supports the show. You can sign up free for 2 weeks, give it a whirl, cancel any time. And we basically write about things that we think you might like, from useful underwear to things you might like to try and cook in your garden, to an entire breakdown of which fine wines might go with which Domino's pizzas. We've actually done that. So next time, a novelist and comedian who has put his body through it over the years, either by staying awake for far too long, succumbing to adrenaline, or taking himself off to an incredibly inhospitable island somewhere in the middle of the Pacific and nearly dying. He's a man who has a lot to be confident about, but who lacks confidence sometimes. A man you might think should be fine, but is beset by anxiety. He is the thoughtful and erudite Mark Watson.
That might be a root cause of anxiety for me, is that I don't, like, the less I can think about what my body's doing, the better, basically, which is probably the same for a lot of us, but I think it's why medical settings are so frightening, because, you know, when you're forced to think about it, like if you ever have to have an ECG and they're sticking stuff on you and listening to your heart and you can see your heart on a screen, all this stuff, I do think that is being much more in touch with. I mean, I'm very lucky. I haven't had that much illness in my life. There are some people, this is sort of their daily reality. But for those of us who have avoided that so far, I think a big reason why hospitals and doctors and stuff are so frightening is because actually looking square on at what your body's up to is immediately makes your body feel worse.
So that's comedian Mark Watson, next time on Manatomy. Bye-bye.